This interview is taking place in the lab on Foley Street on the 22nd of March 2011 for the Shelburne Football Club Oral History Project. Mark Redmond present, making the recording for Dublin City Archive, and with me is Chris Sands. Can I ask you your full name, your date of birth, and your occupation?
Right, my full name, as you say, official, Noel Christopher Sands. Now, over the years, for some reason, Noel wasn't used very much, but it's the official name, Noel Christopher Sands. Born 17th November 1937 in the family flat off Pierce Street, Lord Ernst Street. I was the last of 12 children, but by the time I was born, as was fairly usual at that time, four had died. So in my time, as it happens, it was the sexes were split. It was six and six, and when they died, it was four and four as well. But my father was a docker, William Sands, born in Windmill Lane, near the famous U2 studios, etc. My mother was born on Sir John Rodson's Quay, in the house beside the Sailor's Home. Sailor's Home is a very famous place. Both Windmill Lane are mentioned by Joyce in Ulysses.
Right.
So in a historic area. Anyway, that was me. And then, as happened at the time, my brothers had gone to City Quay School. Now, there was another school actually nearer. But it was like the family history. My mother would say, we're Quay people, City Quay people. Sir John Rodson Quay people. That was a big difference. So I went to school. I reckon I was at school shortly after my third birthday.
Right.
Not that I was brilliant or whatever, but the area was being depopulated. The lads were asked to bring in their younger brothers to keep up the numbers. I was brought in, and I sat beside my brother Bill, who was approximately 8 years older than me, and he was my minor.
And how long have you been a supporter of Shells?
Well, I was born into it.
Right.
My family. My father being a docker. Shelburne were often referred to as the Dockers team.
Right.
A lot of the players were Dockers, including the greatest of all, Val Harris. It was the Dockers team. And my father and his brothers, he had three brothers. I could leave one out, I think, because he didn't seem to show much interest, but the others were. And they would have been the sort of people who travelled, as Shelburne had been founded in 1895.
Yeah.
But by 1906, they were in the Irish League, which was a huge achievement. And they had reached the IFA Cup Final. That is the All-Ireland Cup Final.
They beat Belfast that year, isn't that right?
No, the first one they lost. Then the next one they came back and they beat Belfast Celtic.
Ah, that's right.
Yeah. That was huge, to beat Belfast Celtic. But the first team from what we now call the southern part of Ireland, in fact, possibly the first team from outside Belfast, because the stronghold was Belfast. And Peter Bourne records in the history of the FAI, 75 years of the FAI, he records where the newspapers reported that there were tar barrels lit along Sandymount Beach all the way into Irish town, Ringsend. Although the team was founded by people from Bath Avenue.
Right.
Bath Avenue was the centre. Seemingly there were a few young lads around there. They liked this new game, but there had been football, of course, but it was newly organised. Round 1850,
right,
in Britain, they had organised, setting down the rules and so forth, forming, first of all, what they called the English League, then the Scottish League, then the Welsh, and then the Irish League, and went on from there. But football in Ireland started in Belfast. And these lads, anyway, seemingly were very interested. And they would have played what were called challenge matches. Even in my time, in the 40s,
right,
you'd go to a crowd and say, we'll play it tomorrow, such a place. That was it. It was just simply to have a game. You wanted a game. And you didn't want it just with your own pals, you wanted someone else. And in their case, they were convenient to Beggars Bush Barracks.
Yeah.
Beggars Bush Barracks was one of the major British installations in Ireland. And the story is they would have been playing games against the soldiers, because, of course, Soccer is often in Ireland referred to disparagingly as the garrison game. In fact, I don't accept that as disparaging. I'm happy with that. And if you look at the history of soccer around Ireland, in many cases, it's places that had a barracks.
Yeah.
Athlone is probably the best of all. Athlone was, they're not quite strong now, but they were. But even Tipperary Town, they're not strong in senior, but they are strong in junior soccer.
Right.
And so on. And in this case, anyway, they played it. Now, the story is that, the story I heard, there are slight variations on it.
Mm-hmm.
So at least four variations on it. The story we heard as kids was that arranging a particular game with some of the soldiers outside Beggars Bush Barracks, and the soldiers said, well, what's the name of your team? What do we call you? You know, and they had never arranged a name. And they looked up and there was a road sign which said Shelburne Road. So they said Shelburne. As I say, there are slight variations on that. And that's where it goes from there. So they became Shelburne. And very soon after, they got properly organised. James Roan, a resident of Bath Avenue, and he worked with the corporation, not sure what position, he was the original secretary. And the story is that he walked from Bath Avenue, which is near the top of Shelburne Road, to Finglas, to the home of the secretary of the Leinster Football Association, so as to register that team formally,
right,
so they'd be ready to play. And he walked back, and the records show that they spent something like a halfpenny each on refreshments in Lloyd's Pub in Earl Street. Now, I remember Lloyd's Pub. It's not there now. But I remember Lloyd's Pub in Aaron Street in the 40s, maybe into the 50s. Anyway, they were quite abstemious people, frugal even.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
However, that's the way it went.
You'd have been going to your earliest games in the 40s. Would that have been with brothers, with your brothers?
I reckon. I reckon that there's this thing like the ages of man, you know, this sort of thing. There were these things that you qualified for. Now, it seems to me that once you start school, you qualify to be brought to matches.
Yeah.
Presumably you're toilet trained.
Yeah.
Although I wasn't, because I do remember piddling in my pants and my brother being allowed to leave school early to bring me home, which he was delighted with because he didn't like school.
Yeah.
As it happened, I did. He didn't. No, I didn't at that time, but he did. But now he was the one, he was my minder. And he or my father or my other brother John would have brought me to matches, I reckon, after my third birthday.
Wow.
So that'd be 40. So say January 41 or thereabouts, and that of course was Shelburne Park.
Down on Shelburne.
Shelburne Park, which is now known as the Greyhound Stadium, but in fact it's the other way around. It was a ground which was taken over by Shelburne and was named after the team. Not the other way around.
That's interesting.
And it was at least the third ground. When they moved grounds as they had to, they named the park Shelburne Park.
Yeah.
So they moved to what we now know as Shelburne Park. And then later, the Greyhounds came in. Exactly when, I don't know. But it was that way around.
Well, it was 49, I think they played their final game in Shelburne
Park.
That's right,
that's right.
49.
49. And then they moved, well, they moved around Tucker Park, etc., even Milltown, home of the infamous Shamrock Rovers, the enemy, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
But they moved around, and funny enough, I don't remember any huge problem at the time. We just went, as young lads, we just went wherever there was a game. If Shelburne were playing, we went there. If Shelburne weren't playing, we went somewhere. I actually have a picture. I'm not in it, but a friend of mine has it. And he has him and three of his pals. Three of them are Shelburne supporters. One is a Shamrock Rovers supporters. And they're going to a Shamrock Rovers match. Now, people would say that doesn't happen. That did never happen. But it did happen. You just went to matches.
Yeah.
You supported your own team, but you didn't shout down the others. You know, if they won, so we got the satisfaction that with any luck, at least once a year, Shelburne would beat Shamrock Rovers in Milltown. That was the height of the... It's a little bit like the Celtic Rangers. Not vicious, though.
Yeah.
Not vicious, because there were brothers and even sisters on opposite sides. We had a neighbour The father was Shelbourne. The uncle who lived with him, his brother, was Rovers. The eldest son was Shelbourne. The younger son was Rovers. And I can remember them going to matches together. The 1944 Cup final is famous for that. 1944, Shelbourne had won the league. They were favourites in the Cup final, but they were playing Shamrock Rovers. But the crowd, traditionally, they would march from Shamrock Rovers would march from Ringsend, Shelbourne would march from Shelbourne Park, but they marched together, they mingled together. And unfortunately for us, Shamrock Rovers won. There was a lot of argument about the match, a lot of controversy, but they won. But Shells had already won the league, so it wasn't too bad.
So you, for a young lad, and certainly in the 40s and all, it must have been a great day, great occasion to have early memories of that kind of thing, crowds at matches and stuff.
That was huge. Now, I wasn't at the match because I was deemed too young at the time. More than likely, my mother had stepped in, because I don't think my father or my brothers would have bothered too much about that. And in fact, my second eldest brother, Mike, who had no interest in football, he was actually there. One of the reasons being that he worked with one of the Rovers lads, and he went so he could have an odd little slag with him and so on. But the other two played serious football. John, who was approximately 19 years older than me, and my brother, and Bill, who was approximately 8, he actually signed semi-professional for Drumcondra. And never really got into it because he wanted to play for Shelbourne. Now, at the time, the other thing was, in his job, he was earning good money, and he didn't see it. He had married, had a child, and he didn't see it worthwhile to drop the work prospects for football. Today, some lads would nearly give their right arm for that opportunity. Yeah. But in his case, it proved his merit as a footballer. But he kind of dropped out of it after a while.
Can you remember the earliest memory of going to away matches in Ireland or abroad?
We never travelled much outside the city. First, there wasn't transport. You know, to have as it happened, I had a brother-in-law who drove a work van.
Right.
And he was allowed to take it home on weekends. Now, he would go on trips and he would bring us.
Pile into the back of the
van. He wasn't interested in football. He was an Irish boxing champion.
Right.
He wasn't interested. But as it happened, his best pal played for Shelbourne, Georgie Lynham. But even so, he wouldn't go to see him. They were great pals. One was a boxing champion. The other was a very senior footballer. And that was it. They were friends, and that was it. But anyway, there wasn't transport. And the few people who had cars, very few. Now, bikes, you would have had loads of bikes. In our case, because we lived near Hull Street Hospital, the bikes used to be 6 deep outside for the fathers, the husbands, the father, or the wives. Very often it was only men were allowed into that hospital. Even the girl's mother was not allowed in most cases. But the bikes were all lined up there. And you'd see that around football grounds and all that, 5 and 6 deep.
And which grounds in Ireland do you think did you most like or least like going to? Do you have any particular memories of that?
I don't think, Dalymount was the international ground, so we were happy enough with that. That was, well, at that time it was kept up reasonably well and so forth. Probably Talca, because we went there after Shelbourne Park. Shelbourne Park was like a little playground for us, because the bookies were there on Friday nights, and the bookies had little boxes, stands.
Right.
And we were able to put them even 2 or 3 high if we wanted to watch the match, and we could jump over them and all this sort of thing. So, and another thing about Shelbourne, if my father or my brothers weren't available, we would go down anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I was talking about the ages of man, if you like.
Yeah.
When you went to school, you could be brought to, and as far as I could see, when you made your first Holy Communion, which was usually about 7, you are now allowed to go with your friends, with an older lad, kind of in charge, you know?
Yeah.
And gradually, that's the way it just kind of grew.
Evolves like
that. It just went through like that sort of thing. But even if a father or a brother wasn't there, we'd go down and maybe a neighbour would bunt us over the stile.
Yeah.
That was the usual thing. And if that didn't happen, maybe it would be a bigger match, maybe a bit bigger crowd. Shelbourne had this thing where they always opened the gates at half time. So no matter what the what the score was ever, what match, you could go in at half time, didn't have to pay, and therefore you'd at least see the second half.
Yeah, that was certain.
I'm not sure now that other grounds did it, but I know because, like, oh, we'd have gone to at least 20 matches in Shelbourne Park compared to one in another ground, because
right.
that was where it was.
And how did you? I mean, you were saying earlier there was about the relationship between other supporters and stuff like that. And in the beginning, you'd have family members and supporting different clubs and that type of thing. What was your experience generally of that? Were there fans from particular clubs that you got on better with than other fans, or was there any particular club that there was always a bit of rivalry there?
In our area now, off Pierce Street, we take the library almost as the centre point.
Right.
You know, Shelbourne were founded in Buff Avenue, but they quickly became the Rings End team, and that the major reason for that was their great footballer Val Harris, who was mm-hmm. considered to be a Rings End man.
Yeah.
And so therefore the centre moved to Rings End, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after a while, 1922-23, Shamrock Rovers had been more or less reformed. They had been a junior team, went on to be a senior team, and they went on to a great deal of success. And as a result, most of the Rings End became Shamrock Rovers. Not all of them, there were still a lot of people there, Shelbourne, but the centre of their support moved down to Pierce Street.
Right.
It was always said on the city side of Rings End Bridge, the city side.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of our greatest former players, Arthur Fitzsimons, who was there at the presentation and all that, Arthur is now in his 80s. He actually came from just beside Shelbourne Park, dog track.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in that side there.
South Lots Road and around that direction.
All that, yeah. Dock Street and all that. That was the... But it was Pierce Street was the real strength.
Mm-hmm.
The real strength. In my case, our friends, we just kind of accepted that we were Shelbourne, you know. We just went off. Now, there was one or two, and it would seem to be, if one of the parents was from Rings End, the person might say that they were Shamrock Rovers. I don't remember anybody that I would call a Bohemians fan.
Right.
And I remember two people who are Drumcondra fans. And one of them, even this day, is often referred to as Drums, because he was so unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But we were, as I say, deeply red in that sense. And it was all around the if you like, you can almost take the Pierce Street Library as the centre of the support place.
Now, as you got older as well, and you're kind of going to matches on your own, maybe in your teens or later teens, did you have any unpleasant experiences with other supporters? Did you ever witness any violence between fans? Or when did that start to creep in?
My daughter, oh God, what is she? She might be 50 now. So she was about 20, 30 years ago or so. She was at college, and the people in the college were talking about matches and so on and so on. And she came back and she says to me, bring me over to this. It was actually, I think the first one was Milltown. Pat Bourne's team were playing an Olympic qualifying game against, I think it was Hungary. And we went over, and it was grand. It was a very good game. I think the Irish team might have won. Certainly they would have been in the title to win. I forget the result. But that was Milltown. Now, a while after, the cup final came along. And she said to me, how about going down to the cup final? And that was in Dalymount, and it was Shamrock Rovers and Dundalk. And we stood on the terraces. That was the Connacht Street side, where myself and my pals tended to go when we were much younger. And then people started throwing stones. And I just couldn't believe. I'd never seen anything like that. And then they went out, and they threw stones up and down Phibsborough.
This was in the
Shamrock Rovers and Dundalk FAI Cup Final.
This would have been the 70s.
I think Dundalk had won. I'm not absolutely sure.
This would have been the 70s.
Would have been, yeah. I think Dundalk had won. I'm not absolutely sure. But I'd never seen anything like that. Never seen it. Speaking of Dalymount, two famous matches that I would have attended with my friends. The 51 Cup Final.
Mm-hmm.
Shelbourne were good at getting into Cup Finals. They weren't good at winning them. At this stage, They've been in 17 FAI Cup finals and have only won 7. And most of them were in recent years. But anyway, the 51 Cup final, the parade was coming from Shelbourne Park. Two of my friends and myself, we stood on the porch of Pierce Street Library to meet the crowd as they came along. And we were highly decorated because we had a red white hat. That was about as far as you went, or some sort of a rosette. But there was none of this, all this fancy stuff that you have today. Yeah. Huge expense. One thing they had at that time, and I remember they had it for the 44 final, were rattles or corn crakes.
All right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember one of my brothers getting these from somebody and painting them red and white. That was for the 44 Cup final. Later, match was over. Disappointing for us. A lot of controversy. But a month or so later, that same brother was seen to be painting them green and white.
Right.
Consternation with my brother and my family. What? It turned out he was playing for a team that played in green and white. He got into some sort of a final, so he was redoing them for. But they were, and if you got stuck beside someone with one of those, you were in trouble. Well, anyway, there we were with her, and the worst that would happen to you then, it would rain and the red would come down your face.
Right.
And you wouldn't. Well, we stood there and we marched. The parade came from Ringsend Park up into Dalier Street, across the bridge, up to Dalyman Park, and in we went. And as far as I can remember, it was the only time I was ever under the stand in Dalyman. I don't know why. We must have been shepherded into a particular area. I was never in that before. I was up in the stand after. I was over. I was never there. I don't know why. We weren't long in when the Cork Athletic scored, and it looked like we were gone, because that was the history of Shelbourne in Cup finals. And anyway, eventually Tommy Carberry scored to equalise, to bring into a replay. Tommy Carberry, that meant he had now scored in every round. Unusual feat. Tommy died last year. He was a great personality with the club. But anyway, they then went and did a replay and we lost 1-0. Shelbourne history repeated. Now another one then in Dalymount, I haven't got the date, 60s, famous Yugoslav match. Ireland were playing Yugoslavia. The Archbishop of Dublin said that we should not have anything to do with this godless country.
Well, they're a communist country at the time, aren't they? Yeah.
And said that we should not go. Now my friends, two friends and myself, they were both altar boys. I never was, never, nor do they ever want to be, but the three of us went. Now, I think we lost 4-1 or something, but we were there, and I don't think we really thought much about it. We just thought there was a match on, and that was it. But they were two of the famous ones in regard to Dalymount.
And how did you typically celebrate a Shell's victory?
Well, we weren't drinkers, and we used to go to into our teens, for instance. Right. When we started going to dances, we'd nearly have all the women to ourselves because the fellas were in the pubs. And the non-drinkers would be there and enjoying the early part. Then eventually the place might fill up, but they were usually fellas from the pub. And there were times, in fact, the girls would nearly come looking for you because they wanted to get away from the fellas that had a drink taken. Now, we weren't saints, we weren't heroes, we didn't know anything about it. That's just the way it was. We just didn't think of that drink was important.
So you would have ended up maybe going to a dance or something after?
Yeah. Even so, when I played under 17 under 18 football in the schoolboys league, for instance, The Olympic was the big dance hall at that time.
It was up on Pleasant Street.
It was the biggest hall in Dublin. Mm. And we would go there and we would see the fellas we played with. Mm. Maybe even the fella we'd had an arc with that afternoon, and we'd have a chat with them and so on. And that was a big, big place. That was very popular. Well, it was famous for Lugs Brannigan as well. And you'd have... someone would say then, oh, here's Lugs. And you'd see three fellas running because they knew Lugs was at, would pick on them. Yeah. But one of the huge advantages for us, for the Olympic Ballroom, was because we lived in the Pierce Street area, the late buses from Crumlin, Drimlin and all that, were coming back. At that time, almost every bus left the city area at 11:30. Well, in O'Connell Street, there used to be a line of buses, and an inspector would stand and he'd blow the whistle at 11:30. and the buses would all take off. Now, then they would be coming back. So 12 o'clock, quarter past, when the last dance was 12, back, or the dance finished. Then we would get the bus. Not alone would we get a bus that was leaving us home. When we got a bus, they didn't collect fares. Once they weren't on the run, they didn't collect fares. Yeah. And now that's completely out now. But we were home and so on. That was a great advantage. But the main thing, I suppose, is we would start playing football and we would just become the heroes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know Shane Nolan was one of the fellas that in fact, the one I aspired to most of all was actually Sean Haughey, who was our club captain. And it was the older brother of the politician of similar name.
Yeah.
But Sean went on to be assistant city manager in the corporation. And he was a fine. Now, he had been a prominent Gaelic footballer. He had won a Dublin County medal with Parnells and then played for whatever, 5-6 years. A big, strong player, big, solid player at the time, fullback. And at the time, I thought it was a fullback. Wasn't much of a footballer anyway, but we modelled ourselves on these people and so on. That's that we didn't like drink, certainly never came into it in our case. Now, yeah. I know there were others, there were even people who we had gone to school with who would prefer to go to the pub, and we just left them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
And just the way soccer kind of evolved over the years. If you'd be out in the schoolyard, it'd be kind of in the 40s, that type of thing as well. And if the Christian Brothers school would be very GAA kind of influenced, like that. And if they saw you kicking a ball like a soccer ball, would it be kind of, did you notice any kind of conflict like that between GAA and even the rugby addicts?
To a large extent, in our world of Dublin, if you like, the GAA hardly existed. But after a while, a new teacher came to our school, Joseph O'Driscoll from Cork. He went on to be senior inspector in the department. He hated soccer. And we actually had Billy Young, who went on to be captain and manager of Bohemians. He was a year or two ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
Mick Bourne, who was known as the white-haired physio with Jack Charlton, he was two or three years behind me in the same school. His aunt Mary was the school caretaker. But, now, Charles O'Driscoll anyway tried to get. I don't think there had been a GAA team in the school. Our teacher, the teacher I was with most of the time, Jack Duffsey, he was a rugby man, and he used to say he'd start rugby, and we were saying never have a rugby team. Rugby are all doctors and solicitors and all that. They wouldn't be interested in us, you know. But anyway, the same Charles O'Driscoll, we were supposed to pretend. We didn't know that Jackie O'Driscoll, Irish soccer international, played for Cork Athletic, Waterford, Shelbourne and Swansea Town, and got probably at least 20 international caps, including some north and some south, was his brother. And later, a nephew went on to be even more popular as a hockey international, which was another banned sport.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, the same Charles O'Driscoll brought the teams down to Ringsend Park to play in a trial match.
Mm-hmm.
And as the game went on, one of my school friends, I wasn't involved, I wasn't interested in that at the time. I certainly wasn't asked to go, I just didn't have any interest in it. But one of my friends, I'm still in correspondence with him, he's over in Luton in London, Billy McNevin. The ball came over and he couldn't resist the temptation. He headed a goal. So what did Mr. O'Driscoll? He called off the whole thing. Just couldn't accept that that you were soccer. And his own brother, a professional and international. But there you be. Well, we did go to Croke Park and all that. Like I did see Kevin Heffernan playing.
Right. Yeah.
City Ferguson and all those. And of course, Jock Haughey played. That was Charlie's younger brother.
Mm-hmm.
And the story was at the time he was also playing for Home Farm, but nobody seemed to say much.
Mm-hmm.
Now I do remember being there and that sort of team. I think it was that O'Leary was with the, he was an army man, he was with Uncade Caw, the Irish speaking battalion or whatever,
right, yeah.
It was, but I do remember some country people. I don't know who they were playing, whoever it was, but they kind of sneered at us about the Dublin team that plays soccer. They considered that the type of football Dublin GAA team played was soccer rather than Gaelic football. Yeah. I don't know.
And who would you say over the years, maybe a difficult to choose one particular player, but is there any one particular player that you would say stands out there, you know, in your own memory or in your own opinion, that you'd admire?
Well, the story that I'd have to say in that, Val Harris is the greatest Irish footballer ever. He's a clear contender for that. But of the players that I was seeing, Jerry Malone, who played inside forward for Shelbourne for over 10 years and gained at least one, maybe two international caps, a lot of interleague caps and all that. He would have been the outstanding because he was stylish.
What kind of period of time?
That was in the 40s. Now, coincidentally, Jerry Malone's Aunt Mary was my mother's next door neighbour. That was just, and when we'd be playing football, there's Jerry Malone. Now, that was big. I mean, we knew about English football. We'd no problem with that. Yeah. But we didn't idolise it. We went to our own games. Yeah. And but there's Jerry Malone. My God, you know. Now, there were a few others like that. Georgie Lynham lived near us as well. He was a fitter in the gas company. Mm-hmm. Later on, we used to see him going around town on his orange bike. The gas company stuff was always orange.
The orange bikes, yeah.
Orange. Going into different places to check the gas cookers and so forth. It's, you know, that sort of thing. Another one that I liked, Noel Snell, was another fullback with Shelbourne and captain for a while. And when I started working in the bottom of Grafton Street, around the corner on Wicklow Street, there was one of the famous Finlater shops. Right. Finlater, there was 8 or 10 Finlaters. They were one of these very high quality grocers. And when you went in, you got the lovely smell of spices and all this of thing. And Noel worked there. I don't know exactly what job he did. But as a result, if I came out work for a walk or something like that, I could meet Noel Snell. And again, they were big, you know. And another thing at that time, by the way, later on into the 50s now, maybe, the semi-professional setup with soccer, I think a lot of the players, what they did was, the money they got was the money to buy a house. You know, because certainly in the 40s, very few people had a house or even thought of having a house. You know, even things like the growth of weddings were in the home. You know, my own wedding, although it was in a hotel, we only had about 30 people. That was 1960. You know, and then finished at 3 o'clock.
Finished
at 3 o'clock in the day. But a lot of them went on, as I say, that was what the money did. The sacrifice of playing on Sundays or having to travel to Sligo or so on, you know, and the girlfriend or the wife having to put up with this sort of thing.
Yeah.
The payoff for that was they were buying a house, whereas more than likely his brothers, etc., couldn't.
Exactly, yeah.
You know? Yeah. Now, in my case, we moved into a house in Santry, 1960. Bought with the SDA loan, Dublin Corporation loan, and one of my neighbours was Ollie Conroy, who was then went on to be one of the Shelbourne heroes throughout the 60s. His brother, in fact, was just taken into hospital yesterday. Terry, he was another international. But that was it. Melcy Munro played for Shamrock Rovers. He was another neighbour. And the usual thing, as I say, was that the mortgage was 8.50 a month.
50 a month.
It was a fair amount, but it wasn't. But that's where that went. That was the payoff. And that's why, at the time, some of the good GAA players, etc., wanted to play soccer. Now, they couldn't make that known unless if it didn't work. But that was the payoff for some of them.
And you'd have had reasonable access to players like that in the sense that they were fairly approachable. Kind of people that you kind of knew from the locality, you knew somebody that knew them and stuff like that. Did that change over the years at any stage, or would you say that there's...
Oh, I suppose you got this thing that people... You had this thing that if they're not for you, you're against them. This idea, I just say to people, go and cheer your own team, but leave the others alone. You know, if they, there they are, but cheer your own team. Say, support your own. Please, you don't have to slag the other people. Unfortunately now, something I've heard, a few bad cases, unfortunately there's even people who are supposedly supporters of their own team who are slagging their own players.
I know.
And this type of Facebook thing, seemingly.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not familiar with Facebook. I don't want to get involved, but I'm told it's so easy to put up things and seemingly to remain anonymous.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm only last night someone was telling me about things that were being written about individuals. And in the case of one individual, I would put him as one of the finest players I've seen in recent years, and yet someone is being ultra critical of him. But that's, oh, I don't know. I suppose commercialization and all that, but you know, by all means go and support your own team, but there's no reason to slag and abuse other people.
Absolutely, absolutely. And did you find, you know, you'd have periods with all clubs that have good times and the bad times. How did you deal with losses and other disappointments? I mean, games that you might have been looking forward to.
There wasn't the build-up. You see, the thing, there's so much hype now, but there wasn't. Matches were just matches. Mm. You wanted to win. You wanted to win. But if they didn't win, they didn't win. So what? It's not the end of the world, you know. But then they went on to get them so hyped up. And
it's a huge disappointment then when it doesn't
work. Yeah. Well, I think myself, and of course I accept the possibility that I'm extremely biased, the successful Shamrock Rover teams bred that sort of thing. That, for instance, my recollection is that when Shamrock Rovers were playing in Milltown, Glenmalure Park, if they didn't win, the referee in the line, but they'd be attacked. They would be attacked. And even there were times when they did win, someone still had to go and have a go at somebody. Mm-hmm. Now, in fact, a modern version of that, we saw recently Neil Lennon, the manager of Celtic, and Ali McCoist, the assistant manager of Rangers, were charged. But if you look at the incident, it would seem that Lennon started the argument. It would seem. Now, Lennon's team had won. What was he on about? He won. You know, like, maybe someone would overdo it when they'd lost and they thought they'd been done badly. And so, but you've won. Like, that's... But there, I suppose, all this kind of commercial hype and all this and...
Was there ever a time yourself where you felt frustrated with the club, maybe when things weren't going maybe too well and how did fans kind of cope with disappointments like that? Was it just a case of get on with it?
To a large extent. Now, probably the biggest disappointment with Shelbourne was the time when they moved out of Shelbourne Park.
Right.
And the story is, for some reason, the park was, they didn't own it, you see. It was, now, when I started working in Nassau Street, there was a pub in Suffolk Street, just around the Molly Malone statue. I think they call it the Suffolk Lounge now. Mm-hmm. But that was O'Donoghue's at that time. And Paddy O'Donoghue, I believe, was the name. Cavan man, as a lot of the publicans were. Cavan or Tipperary. But the story was that he owned Shelbourne Park. Now, he probably had bought it because of the greyhound racing. But it seemed then that he offered the park... And the story is it was £500. Now, £500, I don't know how that relates to then. But anyway, the story is that the committee discussed almost all night. They moved into the upstairs room of one of the pubs in Ringsend, and they pushed it to and fro. Anyway, they came to the decision that they would not buy, that they would get a site, and they would build their own. Now, it would seem that was probably pushed most of all by Andy Bourne, who was maybe chairman, but he was chairman later, and that would have been the father of Ollie. And he was, at least for a time, a councillor. He was a Fianna Fáil councillor in his end, and therefore he may have felt he had... I know Ollie at times always gave this impression that he knew everyone inside and he could deal with didn't happen, but anyway, they got the site on what we knew as the dump in Ringsend. When we were kids, our Riviera was the Tower and Sandymount.
Yeah.
The number three bus.
Yeah.
Tower and Sandymount. And we had glorious, it looked like it was always, the sun was always shining. Yeah. That's the way it seemed like. But at the Ringsend end, they had cut off a piece and they began to bring the stuff out, all the rubbish out there. They filled all the infill down there.
Yeah.
And that's all out now as far as...
Pool bag, would it be out the ramp?
It would be well out. It's well out now. But anyway, part of the site was taken over, was bought or whatever by Shelburne. And they began to... They put in a pitch and all that. Now, 51 or thereabouts, I forget now exactly. But we would have attended most of those matches. That was now, as it happened, Eddie Gannon, who was our real local hero in the 40s. In the 40s, Shelburne won the league and he was their hero. So much so that Notts County bought him from Shelburne. He went over there. He wasn't long with them. When Sheffield Wednesday had noticed him, they were a first division team, signed him, and he went on to a lot of success and international caps and so on. But he was a pal of my brother. And when he'd come home in the summer, we'd see him walk from his mother's around Pierce Street to his mother-in-law in Ringsend. And they would, his wife and himself would just walk. That was a summer break.
Yeah.
You know, and here was a first division player, an Irish international player. You know, now, he had come back and he was player manager with Shelburne. And lo and behold, I don't know whether it was his first year or his second, but the most he'd have had was two. Matches were played in the new in Shelburne Stadium, as sinks in Shelburne Park. Shelburne Stadium, Irish Town, okay. Now known as Irish Town Stadium.
Okay.
Part of it, what remains. Problem there was open to all the elements. There was another reason. When they were building, when they laying out the plans, and I actually have a picture of them with the plans and. I don't know whether he was brought into it or he introduced himself into it. Billy Morton was the great athletics promoter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he went on to huge success, no doubt. He brought over Herb Elliott and Ronnie all these in Santry later. Excuse me. But he had some in College Park. But he persuaded Shelburne to put a running track. And he ran Clonliffe Harriers, and then they would move there and they would have an international ground, if you like. So as a result, there was a big, you see some of the European games and you see a running track, and the place is much more open. Crowd is much further away from, but the pitch is, in this case, it was windy, it was out in the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we got terrible results, but terrible reports as well. And I think it was only the 1 year they played, and then they moved into Tolka Park. But not alone that, but they decided that it was partly Eddie Gannon's fault. So they let him go. Now, as it happened, it was Jerry Doyle, who had been a player himself, had been very successful with junior and schoolboy teams, and he took charge, and he then brought us on to one of the really successful periods in the 60s, when we played in Europe and so forth. And that was really historic. But to a large extent, Eddie Gannon was almost sacrificed. Now, the same fella, unfortunately, he bought a small business with the money he had. Footballers at that time were almost uneducated.
Yeah.
It happens now as well, but probably the best example for lads here is Ronnie Whelan, who played for Liverpool. See, his father had been a senior player. He probably had opportunities to go away, but he didn't. He certainly played at least two internationals for Ireland. But as Ronnie was shown promise, he decided he should stay and do his Leaving Cert at least. And he stayed with Home Farm, and Home Farm had gone into the League of Ireland. So he got League of Ireland experience. But he didn't go away as a child. And he had purchasing power and all that sort of thing. But also he was comparatively educated. You know, that didn't happen. But Eddie bought a small business, as it happens, was right beside Shelburne Park. And sure, it did nothing. It just, more than likely, the business was in decline anyway, and they, like, someone just wanted to offload it, but it didn't work, and any money he'd saved or whatever seemed to have gone. As it happened, my brother worked in the ESP in Poolbeg, and it was the job going. I don't know what it was, whether it was a security man or a watchman or a porter or something, and he contacted Eddie. Eddie went in and applied and got it, and he spent his last working years with the ESP, which was good for most people anyway, but unfortunately for him, it was sad, you know. But he had been our great local hero.
And would you have followed any other clubs in Ireland or elsewhere? Or would you have been a devoted Chelsea fan all your life?
No, I wouldn't. I just liked going to them. We went to matches and we saw... Certainly when I started working, I can remember talking with some of the lads in work, coming back from games, particularly the Watford United. Watford FC, with the Fitzgeralds and all that sort, and the Hales.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were wonderful players, wonderful, and very successful. But we still were Shelbourne. If they were playing Shelbourne, we had to expect Shelbourne to win, and hope for Shelbourne. That's the way it was. Now, we knew about English football, no problem. For a time, I had a short newspaper round. I wasn't asked to do it. My brothers would send me down to what we called the corner. If you look out of the library, you see Moroni's.
Yeah.
That was called the corner. Everyone called that the corner. And there was a man sold papers, and I was sent down for the Herald. And then some of the neighbours say, will you bring one for me? And I ended up with 12, 15. But one in particular, our next door neighbour, Mr. Doyle, who was a farrier in Bowlands, they always took the Mail as well on Saturday.
Now,
the Mail was a Protestant paper.
Right.
And some people did follow that as well. They may not even have been religious, but the reason for the Mail on Saturday was the football results. The Mail was the best. Mr. Doyle, there were two, so they never seemed to play football, but they obviously had some sort of an interest in it. Now, as it happened, the two of them were actually took part in the Liffey swim, so they were good swimmers, but I don't remember them ever being involved with football. But we followed all those results, you know. We knew all these players. We went to see Stanley Matthews and all these. They played what they used to call exhibition matches in the summer.
Right.
Most of the clubs. And one of the reasons was, in England you had the maximum wage. It was something like a tradesman's wage plus 25% or something like that. Therefore, it wasn't great, you know. And people like Stanley Matthews would come over because they'd get something like £20 appearance money or whatever it was, you know. And they would even, if they could, they would play in Dublin, Cork, Watford, etc.
Right.
That sort of thing, you know. So we saw all those great players come over here. We were fully aware of them, but we didn't idolise them.
Yeah.
We admired them. We liked them. And we hoped they might even play for our team sometime. And they did. A lot of teams brought over players, not quite Stanley Matthews, but they did bring over top English and Scottish players.
Mm-hmm.
The great Jimmy Johnson actually played for Shelbourne in a few matches. The great Jimmy Johnson of Celtic had won the first British team to win the European Cup. And of course, George Best played for Cork Celtic in a famous game against Shelbourne. Now, the Cork people had a bid for him to do it, and the bidding went too high for them. The story is that Ollie Bourne got onto them because it was a Shelbourne home match, and he said he'd add on another 100 or two because he knew the crowd would come to see, which they did. And as it happened, I think Shelbourne won 2-1. So we weren't humiliated or not. That was in Harold's Cross. That was one of our... Most people didn't like that ground. Just as it happens...
That's where the dog track is now, is it?
It was always there.
Yeah.
But as it happened, I played under 17, under 18 schoolwide football, and then I went to work. I had been working, and then I moved over to the Gresham. In hotels and restaurants, soccer was always big. And in fact, some people got jobs. My own brother might have. That's the reason I followed him in. Might have got it because he was known to be a good player. And when I went to the Gresham then, our outstanding player was Paddy Roberts, who was playing with Shelbourne. But when we got into cup finals, I can't remember how it happened, but I remember it must have been Paddy said it to me, ring trainer. The trainers that were in, there were two trainers were directors of Shelbourne. Danny was one, I'm not sure the other, Danny and whoever, it might have been Danny, but he was secretary of the Capital Cinema Group, who also owned the Ambassador, and he had his offices in the Capital. And when we got into a final, I used to ring him. Mostly, when Paddy Roberts would say it, we'd just ring him, and we'd get the use of Harold's Cross, which was leased to Shelbourne somehow.
Right.
And it was only a matter of contacting the groundsman to say, no insurance, nothing like that, we just went up. And then we would have, in the Gresham, now the Gresham was big, we had all the personalities staying there.
Right.
And we had money to buy gear and all that, which a lot of other teams didn't have.
Yeah.
And we would then play in Harris. And it was, I think I played about six cup finals. I don't remember losing any of them. Oh, one of them was in Whitehall in Home Farm, but the others. And I love that ground because it's a big open ground, but most Shelbourne supporters just had no time for it,
didn't like it.
No regard for it, but they had to play there. Later they loaned at St. Patrick's Athletic when Brian Kerr was the manager, and Brian won the league championship with it, so it's hard to blame the ground.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But that was the least favourite of all grounds, if you like.
And besides actually going to matches, what other ways were you involved in the club, or how would you say what being a supporter of Shells means to you?
I wasn't, you see, we weren't involved in the club. The club was there.
Mm.
There was no connection. Now, one of the reasons there's a connection at the moment is the club is in dire straits,
right,
as most of them are.
Yeah.
Most of them are. I mean, I'm on a committee there, the SSDG. We organised that exhibition, etc. To be on that committee, to be a member of the SSDG, you have to pay so much money.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
Some people say to me, if something came up like, oh, you'll be all right, you'll get tickets. I won't get anything for nothing.
Yeah.
I have to pay money.
Yeah.
But that's what it means to the group of us. Now, you met Joe Dwyer. Joe O'Dwyer, he's one as well. And you're going to meet other people I know, Bernard Connaughton and so forth. And we're there because we're paying money. And we're paying money because we don't want to see the club go under.
Yeah, yeah.
We may never achieve real success, you know, but if it happens, it happens. But we don't want the club to go under. And if we can, if by paying, sacrificing whatever amount, we keep it going as much as we can.
And what type of relationship do you think exists, or do you think should exist between Shells or even any of the clubs like Shells and the wider community? Do you think that has an importance?
Yeah, well, Shelbourne were involved. When Ollie Bourne was there, they were involved in running the scheme in the Larkin College. Do you know where Larkin College is? It's at the back of the Gresham.
Yes, yeah, I think I do.
That's
yeah.
Champions Avenue, in fact.
Yeah.
In the 1930s, there were 8 boxing weights in amateur boxing, 8. They extended that later on. And of the 8, 7 were from the Garden Street area. 7. And of course, there was a notorious fighting area, etc. And it's also, from social studies point of view, significant what weight the 8 was. The 8 was a heavyweight. You didn't get heavyweights in built up areas, you didn't have sunlight.
Uh-huh.
You know, people were small, you know, you might have lived and cramped there, maybe not so much food. So all the other weights were from Gardiner Street. The famous Spike McCormick, Darky Leonard and all these, they were all, and they actually went over to and things like Soldiers Field in Chicago, where they beat the Golden Gloves. Now the Golden Gloves were the American champions, and they beat them. I mean, that was amazing. They were champions. Now, but that college there, which also has a boxing club, I know, Ollie set up this scheme where lads would be invited, I don't know how it's sponsored now. Martin Fitzpatrick, who was on the board of management of Shelbourne,
mm-hmm.
he was also a business editor of the Irish Independent. He was on that committee. I haven't spoken to him about it recently. I don't know, maybe there's no money to start with. I don't know how they do it. But I know it was successful, and it got lads who showed a bit of promise that whatever expenses were paid, I don't know if they got pocket money, I don't know anything like that, but they were paid to stay at school while they learned about football, etc. Now, that would lead on to something like what happened with Roy Keane.
Yeah.
See, Roy Keane, the team he played with, almost everyone on the team got Irish international caps, and he didn't. He's even selected in groups and they never played him. They always said he was too small and kind of got fed up with that. But he joined a FOSS scheme, in fact, to train as a coach. And he was still playing then. He had signed with Cove Ramblers. And anyway, eventually, he went over to Notts Forest. And Brian Clough saw him play one half a match and said to him, come off, reserve team game, half a match, said, come off, you're coming with us to Liverpool on Friday. Didn't tell him you're starting on Friday. I mean, that was utterly, but the debt he owes to Brian Clough for that, because we've all seen very good players, mm-hmm. and you often wonder what happened. And it's sometimes, You only look at Alex Stevenson or Alex Ferguson and Yap Stam, for instance, who was a brilliant centre half for Manchester United. It's sort of dispute with him. Got rid of him. He almost disappeared after that.
Yeah.
If he'd stayed with Manchester United, he would have had maybe at least five more years. It's amazing. Talent is great, but the luck goes with it as well, you know?
Yeah.
And who knows? But anyway, they were involved in that, I know. To what extent they are still, I don't know. But that's the sort of thing, certainly, we'd all like to see.
Absolutely. Before we finish, is there anything that you'd like to add? I think I might have forgotten to ask, or any other particular memories?
No, I think we've covered most items there. It just, you know, I think soccer is... a lot of people don't agree with using the word soccer. I know Mary Muldowney, when she did the thing in Trinity, the fellas were talking about football and that, and she put it in the soccer, and she said I was devoured, but some of them, because they don't like to give away, but it does distinguish it from Gaelic football.
Yeah.
We used to call it Gaelic. Even actually, Johnny Giles, I just finished reading his book, lovely read, and he was one of talked about as Gaelic, not football, just Gaelic. Football was soccer, you know. But association football, as it officially would be, it's a simple game. You know, like you, two coats and a ball, and even the ball. Bill Cullen in Penny Apples describes his father making a ball from paper and cord and twine, and people did that. You know, and my early recollection was we played with what the older fellas call a chamois, which was a worn tennis ball.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was down to the rubber. There was no coating on it. And eventually we moved on to what new things came on the market. We called a bouncer. That was a ball. It wouldn't be the size of a football. And there was a company down in Mayo, I know, Mayco. And they did all these plastic products. And then we began to get a plastic ball of the same size as, and so on. But you didn't get, like this idea of having a foot, looking at some of the young fellas, like some of them can hardly kick a ball, and they have a full Manchester United outfit, boots, the lot, everything. And my God, the amount of money. And there's times, I look at some of the fellas going, people going around with babies even. Yes. Yesterday I saw a baby with a suitor with the Liverpool insignia on it, you know. But the money they spend, if they would only divert about 10%, go down to see your own. The lads playing there might be your next door neighbour.
Yeah.
Go down to see him, you know. It's good value. I mean, we had a great game there the other night. Shells 3-0 in 15 minutes. And then a fourth one. Then we gave away a penalty just before the break, 4-1. Then we let in a soft goal in the second half, 4-2. And then it was a bit of a tussle to keep it going. Grand. And first game I've seen this year. And we certainly have a number of players who look extremely... Well, they are very good, I know, because they've established records. But we have them now only because the money is bad all around. And some of them have been full-time footballers, but they're only part-time. I've no idea what they're actually being paid. We don't interfere with that. We provide them with money if we can, where we can, to keep... Above all, we have plugged the gaps in... like leaking roofs and all that sort of thing. You know, you may know that the leaks, they have licenses now, and they come and inspect, and if you don't do this, you don't do, if your electricity's not done in a certain way, etc., etc., you know. And unfortunately, parts of Talca Park is a little bit derelict because there was no upkeep. But when it opened first, especially the new stand from Condra, it was terrific. Although, let me finish with a little incident that happened there. One of the official linesmen, our referees inspectors, was a work colleague of mine, and they always had a little running battle with Ollie. Ollie Bourne was, well, he was a monster or an ogre to a lot of people, but he was a law unto himself. Now, in fairness, you may have heard when things went bad with Shelbourne, that was 2006. We actually managed to clinch the league, but once we got the league, we fell apart. But as well as that, we were punished. Now, look, if you look at what was done with Shelbourne and look at the other teams after that, we were very badly treated. You know, we were part of it was people getting back at Ollie Bourne, part of it. And part of it was that they had to ease up the punishment later because they'd have no teams.
Yeah.
If they'd applied the same rules, for instance, the Drogheda, or even Bohemians, as they did Shelbourne, they were gone. You know, but you don't want dead bodies all over. It doesn't do anyone any good. But however, but when the new stand opened, terrific change of rooms for the lads, all that, lovely stuff, so on. And lovely, lovely rooms for the officials, and nice little fridge, and bottled water and milk, and a kettle to make a cup of tea and all that sort of thing and so on. And after a while, let me go back to the Ollie thing. But they did live line, they did an assassination job on Ollie, and in particular I remember one or two very prominent Bohemian supporters really getting the knife in, and because they got the, now they rang me to know would I go on, and I said I would. And they came back to me and said, what are we going to say? Well, I said, I'm not going to criticise Ollie. Ollie has his faults. The club wouldn't exist. The club wouldn't exist. And he has his faults. I mean, Ollie had a criminal record. He had done, you know. But the club itself wouldn't exist. It was gone. But anyway, this time he was having a little tussle with the officials. Things weren't going as well as he'd have liked, which meant we should have won every match. But he took out the fridge and the kettle, or the fridge and the kettle, took out the facilities from the officials because things weren't going his own way. And there was nothing they could do because it wasn't a requirement.
Yeah.
You know, that was part of Ollie. But as I say, Ollie was at least a colourful character, and some of the colours were very dark, some of them. But that's football is great like that, that you can have all these personalities. You have you mention yourself, even Joe Dwyer. Joe's a great man to every now and then, and so on. And Oliver, our friend Oliver, is a soccer man from Sligo. As he said himself, for various reasons, Sligo is much more a soccer town than anything else, you know. But you get these so many characters. Talking about the ups and downs and things and all that, some years ago there was a famous character died in Ringsend. He was a Shelbourne supporter. Most Ringsend, Shamrock Rovers, but he was a Shelbourne supporter. And a friend of his did an obituary for him. And this friend was a Shamrock Rovers supporter, but he described him as a staunch Shelbourne supporter. Now, I know the man who did it. wrote the obituary for that, and I said to him, Jesus, Tony, I said, could you be anything else? You have to be staunch, because we're always getting stuffed, and worst of all, by Rovers. You know, like, you could put up with so many others, but all you did was you put your tail between your legs and you slunk off home. And this thing of violence after, and we're here now, especially the Glasgow derbies, that there's a the wife beaten and all that after the match. Holy Moses. Now, you know, now we've had that down there, not quite, but we've had young lads go down and they attach themselves to the club. In fairness to Joe Casey and the committee, there's time, I know they came into the stand one time, two lads were shouting abuse at the referee, and they went up to them and said, now lads, keep quiet or get out. And they kept, I never saw or heard them, but they were deplorable, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And sure, that's not what life's about. Life should be there to be enjoyed.
Absolutely. Chris, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for coming in today.